How can men best help feminism?
It's a question a lot of men I know have been asking.
I heard very clearly from women, feminist women, that the most appropriate role for men who cared about sexism and misogyny and men's violence against women and gender inequality was to educate, politicize, and organize other men.
That's Jackson Katz, and we're going to be asking him and others what men should be doing in this pivotal moment in history on this episode of The Gender Knot, the podcast where we untangle the new masculinity and femininity. We're your hosts. I'm Nastran Tavakoli-Farr, but you can call me Naz.
And I'm Jonathan Freeman. We'll be speaking to the writer and educator, Jackson Katz, as well as the psychotherapist, Eugene Ellis, to find out what we men should be doing if we want to best help feminism.
Before we start the conversation, are you willing to go through the uncomfortableness of it?
Welcome to The Gender Knot and the start of our second season. I'm going to give you a quick rundown of how this show works. I'm a journalist based in London, and in each episode we take an idea or question or concept related to gender and we try to figure it out and see if there's a solution. The process starts with me calling our co-host Jonathan Freeman, who's usually based in Washington, D.C. He's worked in politics, business, and the military, and he's also wrapping up a PhD. We start to untangle the question, and then I go off and interview some people, and then Jonathan and I get together at the end and see if we can figure out the dilemma. Also, just to let you know that we love getting your feedback, thoughts, and ideas, so do drop us a line. You can find out more at our website, thegendernot.com, and also please do leave us a review on iTunes. Okay, let's get to work and let's call Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan, how's it going?
It's going great. I guess today is our first episode of the second season.
Yeah, and it's great having you as a co-host.
Wonderful to be here, part of the team.
So how are we going to start season two? What's our question?
We're going to go for gold, and we're going to ask, how can men best help feminism? And I think this is a subject that's really important for many men, not just myself. And I think it's something that we are wondering, given how important feminism is in general, but how much it's become prevalent in social awareness given the Me Too campaign. Naz, what do you think?
So this is an interesting one because it's quite a loaded issue. We briefly looked at this in season one, but I personally think men can best help feminism by listening and not by jumping in and trying to do something all the time. I think they can best help feminism by listening to women's experiences, asking women about their experiences, observing dynamics that happen in the workplace and families and society. And, you know, by doing all this listening and observing, then eventually that will lead them to behaving in ways that will help feminism. A lot of the frustration a lot of us women are having at the moment, and you saw this very much after Me Too, where men suddenly jumped in and they wanted to get involved and they wanted to like do something, which kind of basically had the effect of making everything about men again. And that is a problem that I feel like a lot of us women face. Like, you know, we just want men to just listen without like suddenly being the center of attention, because in a way they already are the center of attention, because a lot of the problems are to do with things that men do, either as individuals or as a society. But again, it kind of all becomes about men. Do you know what I mean? Does that sound harsh?
No, it doesn't sound harsh, but just to, again, to take the token male perspective, from a male dynamic, you know, I want to do something. There is something wrong in the world, and that I want to do something in order to make it better, or in order to, for me to not be in some way tacitly participating in a bad behavior. And you're talking about a bad behavior that is prevalent within sort of a dominant gender, a dominant class. And so I think the instinct of, okay, let me make it better and let me do something to make it better is an instinctual one. It's not necessarily a question of wanting to ignore women, or even more importantly, and to your point, say, oh, it's really all about me being a male. It's about, okay, I see something wrong and I need to do something in order to help correct it. And so then the question, but you're saying that the most important thing to do is to sit back.
Yeah, kind of. And it's interesting hearing you say all that, because I do know I sound a little bit harsh, because like you say, a lot of men are maybe being very well intentioned. But I'll give some examples. So we talked about this in season one, where we were talking, there was a section where we talked about male feminists, and myself and my guest were saying how we feel like people who are male feminists often use that as a way to extend their own brand and to win kind of brownie points for themselves. So, you know, I made the example of, you know, investors, for example, who talk about how they want to help women and they come and just talk on panels on behalf of women instead of, like, you know, hiring some women on their board. Like, that's what you can do to help the cause of feminism. You can hire women. You can ask for women's opinions when, you know, you want to get a more diverse set of experiences, which is kind of very different to this, like, hero style dynamic of I am here, what can I do? Or something we saw after Me Too a lot. Loads of men coming forward and talking about how they felt bad about times that they had harassed a woman or times that they had been mean to women. And it's kind of like, no, this isn't about you to go on about yourself right now. I think that's really the frustration. We're going to speak to Jackson Katz in a bit. He's this fantastic educator and author, and he's got this great TED talk about violence against women where he says it's a men's problem. But I'm just going to read a quote from him because I think he explains this really well. So he talked to Time magazine about Me Too and what men can do. And he said this, he said, "You should listen quietly and intently to whatever women want to share about their experiences and reassure them that you're most concerned about their well-being. Then gently ask what you can do to help. The idea is not to jump in and try to fix the problem, but to let her know that you care about her and support her in whatever way she deems most useful. In many instances, women who've been abused by men have already suffered a loss of control at the hands of an abuser. The last thing they need is for another man to jump in and seek to reassert control, however well-meaning he may be." And I just think that's kind of perfect. It's like, no, like, I know you're trying to help, but you're sort of taking control of the situation, which is kind of what the problem is.
Sure. I guess my question is if we're all so kind of sitting around and kind of feeling about it and just hearing feelings, does anything actually ever get done?
Well, long run.
And then you just kind of continue to perpetuate the problem, which is, I think, what we are all agreeing we don't want to do.
I think long run things will change. So my whole thing about how men shouldn't do anything is about you don't need to do anything now. You don't need to fix anything now. But by hearing women's experiences, like I said, you know, in 5 months' time, when you come to hire someone, you're like, maybe I will hire this woman. But, you know, it's all these little ways in which we do things that are significant. So it's about sort of men listening and understanding so that on the daily they will behave in so many small ways that are more equitable rather than being this big hero who fixes.
Got it. So you're talking about, like, rather than just sort of a one-pointed nature of focus of the to-do list or whatnot, you're talking about more of a holistic aspect in the little and the thousand little things that create sort of a society.
Yes. And then the other problem that comes about is that and this comes up in terms of men listening, is that often as women, we have to deliver the message in a way that doesn't offend men. Now, on one hand, I understand that generally in social discourse, we should try to be civil with each other. But it gets to the point where, you know, we end up having to cater to men's feelings. And given that, like, men are the status quo, often women are going to be angry about a situation or a dynamic. So it's this whole thing of, like, men being very much like, "Ooh, don't be angry when you tell me." Or, you know, "Tell me in a way that doesn't make me feel bad." And, like, given that women do so much emotional labor to not offend men, it's like this is just an extra bit of emotional labor that, whereby I want a guy to listen to why I'm angry about a situation. But it's like, ooh, I need to do it in a way that doesn't offend him, which is also something that came up in the Men and Feminism episode in season one. And, you know, that is very infuriating to women. And what has been really exciting about Me Too has been seeing all this, like, anger from women. And this whole kind of notion that people need to sort of not show their anger is also quite dangerous, because I think the other party doesn't take how seriously a problem is if there's no anger to it. You know, if it's kind of been removed of all of the, you know, hurt and it's been sanitized, they don't really get how serious it is and how hurt the other party is. So yeah, that's another thing. It's like, try to listen and try to not make it all about you and how you feel, because it's obvious that the other person's going to be hurt and angry.
Sure. I recently re-listened to that episode, and I'll tell you, that was the one section that sort of pissed me off, is the feeling of indignant, you know, coddling that some men seem to feel that they need in order to kind of be allies. And that does not make a whole lot of sense to me, because at the end of the day, you know, if from a purely societal construct, we see that we are the dominant power, you know, white men are a dominant power, then it's, you know, then it's beholden to us to be extraordinarily more sensitive, to be more equitable, to go the extra mile, because we have the power, so to speak. And so, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to sit there and be like, oh, you know, you're not being, you know, warm and cuddly in your social critique. That just seemed like a bunch of crap to me.
I really like the way you framed that, because it sounds like you're asking for white men, in this case, to step up, which is kind of, I wonder if that appeals to men as well, but that's quite an attractive quality about masculinity, you know, the sort of stepping up.
Exactly. I think of it as white men, but I mean, I guess even to be more specific, we could be like white Christian men,
and you know, straight
within
as
Western
well.
Society, straight white Christian men. So I am, you know, not Christian, but throughout history, we've seen white, straight, you know, Christian men have had power and have had to give it up and have done so grudgingly in some ways and have done so, you know, have done so less grudgingly, have done so grudgingly, and have done in a far more,
in a much more graceful.
Thank you. That's a brilliant word. This is why you're the radio broadcast professional. Anyway, in a much more graceful way.
But it's strange you put it that way, because I feel like that might appeal to men. I also, on some level, think that we listen to people who are similar to ourselves. So it's going to make more sense that, like, men will listen to other men about how to be better feminists, even though that annoys me on some level. But, you know, I can see logically how that might be the case.
I think the challenge for us is the idea of doing less, that less is actually doing more.
Right.
And
right.
That's sort of the biggest sort of, intellectual gender leap. It's like, okay, there's something wrong. We need to do something. Okay, what are we going to do? Okay, we're going to do nothing.
But listening isn't doing nothing. That's the thing. Hard and like proper, like not passive listening, like listening as in actually taking it in and going away and thinking about it and then acting on it later. I think that's the problem. Maybe this is a bigger social problem with listening, because then it stops being a gender thing, because I think many people in society just don't really know how to listen to other people. Maybe
sure.
That's the
no,
problem.
I mean, when the Me Too movement began and sort of was well underway, like I asked certain women in my life, you know, about their reactions, their thoughts, and I sat back and listened. And I'm not sitting here, you know, putting myself up as the paragon of all men, but there was clearly, like, especially given some of the violence that they had experienced that I had no idea about, like, it wasn't for me to comment, and it wasn't for me, you know, like, there was just no place for me to do something. Like, all I could do is say, you know, I'm sorry that it sucks that you had to go through this, and, you know, when and where you need me, I'm always there for you.
It's funny, because you say all I could do, and I often think good listening is the best thing we can do. It's such a powerful thing. But just to go back a second, do you think I am being unfair? Everything I said at the start about how, like, men just don't do anything, listen, all these things that piss me off, do you think that's kind of unfair, you know, that...
I don't know that it's unfair. I think it's your perspective. How can you say that anyone's perspective is unfair?
But
it's
do you listen like to... Do you hear that as a male and think that, oh, all of these men are, like, really trying their best and she's coming and she's kind of shooting them down?
Maybe, but at the end of the day, given how understandably pissed so many women are and how poorly so many women have been treated for so long, like, it's understandable that there's a little bit of frustration and a little bit of anger, and too damn bad to us.
Okay, so Jonathan, I am going to go speak to a few people about this question, and then you and I are going to have a chat at the end and try and figure out how men can best help feminism. We mentioned Jackson Katz. I'm going to be speaking to him, and I'm also going to be speaking to a psychotherapist. Now, he's really interesting because I was at a conference for shrinks recently, the sort of thing I do on a Saturday, and it was a conference about men in therapy, and this therapist is a Black British male, and he was talking about trying to educate white therapists about issues that people of color face, but that you have to kind of try and deliver the message in a way that they will understand and that they will hear. And while in some ways that is a logical thing to do, he was asking, at what point do you end up basically pandering to white people? That made me think of this dynamic with me as a woman trying to get men to listen and trying to be strategic about that, but then at some point being like, yeah, but why am I sort of trying to take care of your feelings again? So him and I had a really interesting chat on that.
It's interesting that there would be that commonality on the racial side to the gender side. So I'm looking forward to hearing them.
Okay, I'm going to go speak to some people and I will get back to you.
Brilliant.
Okay, speak soon. Bye-bye.
So, first up is Jackson Katz. I called him on the phone over the holidays and asked him about what men can do to best help feminism.
The Me Too moment is an incredible moment, right? There's no doubt that because of women coming forward in a way that's unprecedented, including high-profile women, and then there's been a cascading effect where women all over the place have been coming forward. Men who are care about women can no longer sit in any kind of denial like they might have before as a way of not getting involved by saying something like, you know, well, these are problems, but they're not really that big a problem, or it's not such a big problem in my family, or I don't think abusive behavior is okay, but, you know, it's not really an issue that I need to concern myself with. Because that's how a lot of men orient to this. The Me Too moment has sort of obliterated that as an excuse for men to not be active, because so many women have come forward, and not just high-profile women, but women across the board, across the class and race and ethnic spectrum, and in small communities and large. So in other words, men now have to say, I've said I care about women, I care about gender justice. All these women have come forward. Now I can't be in any kind of denial that this is a gigantic problem. What can I do? That's an important moment, and I think we need to capitalize on it, or at least we need to take advantage in a positive sense of that energy and harness it. And I would hate to see men backing away from engaging with these matters because they're afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing and being misperceived or such. I mean, one of the things that I say all the time to men is I'll say, you know what? If you really care about these issues and you really care about speaking out about sexual assault and harassment and abuse, and both for the women around you, but also women more generally, and men around you and men more generally, then if you're going to speak out, if you're going to engage, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to say things that you regret, or you're going to say things that others, including women, might take the wrong way or might criticize you for. That's okay. You know, it's okay. If you're really committed to the work, then you take the criticism, you take the feedback. You don't have to agree with it every time, because just because someone, you know, criticizes you doesn't mean that they're accurate in their criticism. They can, you know, you could agree or disagree, but you have the integrity to listen to what they're saying and take it in, and then figure out how not to do it the same thing the next time, or how to integrate their insights into your understanding of these issues in a better way, and move on and go to the next level. Everybody who's committed to social justice, especially if you're a member of a group with privilege, is going to make mistakes. I make mistakes all the time over the many years of my activism, of course. But if you're committed to it, you don't back away after one bad incident. Because, you know, sometimes guys will come up to me and say, well, you know, I was involved and I was speaking out for women, and then I was at this, meeting, and I made some comment, and this woman jumped on me and said that what I had just said was incredibly insensitive or sexist, and I'm like, I'm not going to do anything anymore. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. I'm not going to say anything. My response to that is, if you're really committed to gender justice and one comment made you shut up and not ever talk about this stuff again, then I question your commitment in the first place. Because if you're truly committed, you're going to learn from it, grow from it, and move on. You're not going to just be quiet. And I do think we're in a moment where some men are really, really unclear about what role they can play. And so a lot of men are very tentative. And I appreciate, by the way, that's part of being a strong ally, is being cautious about what toes you're stepping on or the politics of this. And I think it's important to state that men engaged in feminist work, if you will, have to be very sensitive to the gender dynamics, that men historically have had so much more power than women, that now that women's voices are finally coming to the fore, you don't want to shout over women and, you know, sort of co-opt women's spaces. I don't call myself, for example, a feminist. The men that I work with, all the men that I work with over the many years, we say we're pro-feminist men, as opposed to saying we're feminist men. And people could say, well, what's the difference? Well, pro-feminist suggests that there's some separation between the ideology and the identity, that a man can't occupy the identity, but he can support the ideology. And so if you say pro-feminist, you're suggesting that you are aware of that dynamic, that you're completely supportive of feminist change and transformation and individuals, but that you're not claiming the identity in a way that could be zeroing in on or honing in on or co-opting women's primary identification with that term at this moment in history. This is a debate that we've been having in feminism more broadly and men's engagement with feminism for 40 years. But the term that we've settled on is pro-feminist man. So when you see somebody described as a pro-feminist man, or he describes himself as a pro-feminist man, you know that he's aware of these dynamics. When I hear a man say he's a feminist, I often think, okay, maybe he's not aware that we've been having these conversations and that where a lot of the really more engaged men have landed is in this term, on this term pro-feminist man. As earlier, you know, you would ask about, don't men need to listen to women, which they of course do, and read women's literature and read women's writing and read feminist theory. They also should listen to and learn from the men who have taken feminist ideas and applied them to men's lives, including in relation to how to enact your power and privilege in struggles for gender equality with women. Because my fear is that if men don't do this sensitively and smartly, many of them will step over lines, and then there'll be backlash, and then there'll be discomfort, and a lot of people will withdraw. And I don't think that's a good thing. I do think we need a lot more men working together with women on these issues. These are gigantic issues for the human species and for the 21st century. And with the rise of the right wing, both in the United States and in Europe and other parts of the world, with the rise of fascist and neo-fascist movements, theocratic movements, by the way, both of which, fascist and theocratic movements, are explicitly anti-feminist. That point can't be emphasized enough. When you have fascist political movements, a big part of what they're trying to suppress is women's equality and gay and lesbian and transgender rights. Anybody who's concerned, who's a man, who's concerned with the advances of the right and the far right all around the world has to know that part of that advancement is based in anti-feminist anger and political belief. And so if you want to be aligned against fascism and against the dark forces that are seemingly on the rise around the world, you have to join in hand in hand with feminist activists and LGBT activists, as well as anti-racist and, you know, sort of pro-democracy activists. And men have an incredibly important role to play in all of that. I think sitting on the sidelines and saying, I'm not going to get involved because this stuff is too tricky interpersonally and it's awkward and I'm not sure what to do, is not a good answer. I think the challenge is, how do you do it? How do you do it right? And how do you stick with it for the long haul?
Jackson, you referred a moment ago to the fact that you are going to get it wrong, you're going to make mistakes, that's totally fine. Something that I find happens a lot is that, you know, myself or other women will, you know, tell men who are trying to help out ways in which they get it wrong. And like you said, often there's a bit of shutting down. Okay, this is too hard, I don't want to get involved in it. I'm wondering, though, not to just put all the focus on men, are there things women can do to help men who are trying but are getting it wrong? Because, you know, it's like a two-way dynamic here. Are there ways in which women can be quite unfair in this dynamic with, you know, men who, as you say, are wading into something that is already quite sort of nuanced and sensitive?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a little awkward for me, and I'll tell you, this might be an important point here. It's a little awkward for me to give advice to women, right? Because, like, people will come up to me, Nass, I've given, you know, thousands of talks, right, all over the world, right? And I do this a lot. And at universities, at conferences, in all kinds of different settings. And I'll often be asked by women, and not always in public, but they might be, you know, after my talk on the side, they'll say, what should I say to my boyfriend who, you know, who doesn't really take this stuff really seriously, or he acts a different way when he's with me alone, he's a really good guy. But then when he gets it with his guy friends, he acts in these other ways that I really have a problem with. And I always say, I can give you some insight perhaps, but I'm not going to tell you what to do. It's not right for me. It's not appropriate for me to tell you what to do. I can maybe give you some insight into what I think might be going on. But I have to qualify it like that because I don't want to be seen as this guy, this man, is telling women that they need to such and such in the face of sexist men, you know. And by the way, I think one of the reasons why it gets really, really difficult is on an interpersonal level is a lot of women, one of the reasons why a lot of women will keep feminism at arm's length in a metaphorical sense. They won't claim the title feminist. They'll make critical comments sometimes about feminists, activists going too far and being extreme or whatever it is. I think in part because of those women want to maintain their relationships with men, and they fear that if they do strongly step out and embrace what feminism implies, which is women should be treated with full respect and dignity, and every bit as much as men should, that they'll somehow lose male approval, they'll lose male friendships. If they're heterosexual, they're worried about shrinking the pool of eligible, you know, male suitors, if you will. There's all kinds of, in other words, consequences as a woman for taking a feminist stance. And some of those consequences involve their relations with men. And so I think, for example, a lot of women won't assert their own dignity in an interpersonal relationship with men, whether it's an individual man like a boyfriend or something, or husband, or even a male friend. They often won't assert their dignity because they worry that if the man doesn't then change his behavior based on her sharing what she needs, if you will, then that man has made a decision that he doesn't really care about her that much. And I think a lot of women don't want to hear that either. You know, it's really hard. Because, for example, if you're a woman and you say to a guy, look, the way you talk and make these comments really hurts me. And I really, I think I love you, I like you, I want to hang with you. But when you say that, it really hurts me. If he continues to do it, then he's made the statement that his, whatever pleasure he takes, whatever identity sort of validation he gains from making those kind of statements is more important to him than taking care of your feelings and your concerns. That's not an easy thing to hear. So a lot of women just don't even want to go there. They won't say it because their fear, whether they're conscious of it or not, that they're going to hear the wrong thing and then it's going to have consequences for their relationships. But yes, of course, women play a role in helping men develop sort of better understanding of these issues. And this is very similar to with racism. I think there are some of the best leaders that I've encountered, African-American and other people of color. As a white person, what I've heard from some of the better thinkers that I've been, influenced by is to white people, yes, you have an important role to play. And yes, you should be doing this. But yes, you are going to make mistakes. And it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means that you're a white person growing up in a racist culture where you can't avoid breathing in the air of racism. Everybody does it. Everybody is influenced by racism. Everybody's influenced by sexism. And everybody's influenced by misogyny. And that's not just men, women as well. And so if women can say to men, I expect more from you, but I don't expect you to be perfect. And I think you're going to make mistakes. And you're going to, as a man who's a product of a sexist culture, a sexist society, a sexist world, you're going to have some of that. I have some of that. Me personally, of course. I'm not going to say that I'm, some perfectly evolved human being who doesn't have any traces of sexism. That's ridiculous. So I think if women can say that, I'm still holding you accountable. I still want you to do this and this, but I don't expect you to be a perfect human being and you're going to make mistakes. I think that's a powerful thing that women can say and that men can hear. And that it takes a lot of the pressure off of men feeling like because they're not perfect, so somehow they're not capable of doing anything constructive. One other related point, Nas, I think a lot of men hesitate to get involved politically and in social sort of struggle around feminist issues because they feel like hypocrites, because they feel like they are sexist and they have sexist attitudes and beliefs and maybe even have committed acts of abusive behavior towards girls and women. Who knows? And they'll think, well, who am I to tell other men? Who am I to speak out on these matters because I'm guilty, if you will? And my response to that is, if we're going to wait till the men who are involved in feminist struggle are men who are perfect and who have no baggage, then we're going to wait forever because it's never going to happen. So you have to say, even in spite of the fact that you might have baggage, in other words, your own attitudes and beliefs might not be perfectly anti-sexist or unsexist, or you might have done things in your past that you're not proud of. Even so, we expect you to be part of the struggle. And again, it's very similar to white people. I don't think any people of color that I know who want white people to be more active in the anti-racist movements are expecting that the white people who are involved are perfectly anti-racist, or excuse me, have no, racist, bones in their bodies or something silly like that. They don't expect that. They just expect you to be committed to working through it and doing whatever you can with integrity to work towards justice. And it doesn't mean you have to be perfect. So I think if, to the extent that women can communicate that, women in the movement, both interpersonally and publicly, I think that's very constructive and helpful. And I think it gives men a little bit more space than some men feel they have to screw up and have some of these contradictions. And I think we're all human and we all have contradictions. And I don't think that's a horrible thing.
That was Jackson Katz. Next up is Eugene Ellis. He's the therapist I mentioned when I was talking to Jonathan. He's the founder of the Black, African, and Asian Therapy Network. Now, Eugene is a Black British male, and he runs many sessions for therapists. These sessions are to help them understand racial dynamics. In the UK, at least, most therapists are white, and if they have a client who's not white, then it's pretty important that they're aware of the experiences and dynamics that that person faces. Now, what is interesting is that Eugene is going to tell us about these groups and what happens when people of colour try to share their experiences. What you need to remember is that this is a group made up of therapists and aspiring therapists. Being a therapist is all about being open, non-judgmental. It's about not getting defensive. It's about listening to other people's experiences and going into uncomfortable situations with them and sitting there through the pain and not shying away from it. And that the people who've attended these sessions have done so willingly. They want to be there and to do the work. But let's see how these conversations go down, even among some of the most open-minded people who are all about going into the pain in an effort to heal. I paid Eugene a visit and he told me more, and we're going to see what we can learn from him and how it could apply to men who want to best help feminism.
The main question we're trying to answer is how can men best help feminism?
Yes.
But a sub-question is, me as a woman, how can I best ask men to help? Because often I'm speaking to men and they're like, okay, I can see why you're annoyed at me or at us. What do you want me to do? And then that opens up an interesting sort of Pandora's box of reactions. Because on one hand, I'm like, okay, it's great, you want to help out. And I also believe it's, as someone who likes to consider myself intelligent, I like to think that it's good to be strategic. Not in a, strategic maybe sounds inauthentic. It's good to be smart about how you approach things. And, you know, it's not someone's fault that they're a male. Like, there's nothing wrong with being a man. How can I best talk to men to get them involved? But sometimes I feel like that dynamic in itself is that I have to go and make a hell of a lot more effort for this person who wants to get involved, whereas I already have all this shit to deal with. So it's this double-edged sword of like, yes, I should learn how to ask men to help, and then it's like, well, why should I? So I don't know, it's a really frustrating area.
It is a very difficult place.
And in your talk, you said something about trying to bring white colleagues on board, but then at what point are you, I think you said, are you pandering to white people? Or it was a word similar, and I was like, that is a really good word.
I mean, if I talk about the therapist forums which we run, so they are for counsellors, psychotherapists who want to work better with their clients, and we invite people of colour and white people into that space, and we have a race conversation. And the race conversation is normally around something that's happened to them, so a particular event. There's a couple of things. First of all, for me personally, I think there's an expectation in other people that I'm going to give these white people hell, you know. I'm going to give them what for, because they need to understand. And then for the white people, they assume I'm going to be there to give them what for. and then they're going to have a hard time in this space, and they're going to be told off for getting it all wrong.
But in a way, it's good if they go in with that expectation. It's like way nicer. Like, that's the opposite of, I think, what happens with me when they're like, oh, she's going to be friendly. And then I'm like, this is what I really think of you.
I mean, it's therapy is supposed to just sit with the uncomfortable and be available for the client. So, and in a way, I think that just the sharing the uncomfortable space is mostly a lot of the work, without defending yourself, without attacking them, which is normal life. Normally, people express their hurt and they're, you know, and they get a kind of a, you know, sort yourself out or whatever people say, which is not very helpful. So anyway, so that's the kind of spaces that people in the therapy world sort of find themselves in. And then if someone kind of says, I'm a black man, this is my experience, or I'm a woman, and whatever they, you know, whatever oppression that they're kind of experiencing, and then people will respond or react, probably mostly with, maybe not all white people are racist, or they might feel really guilty and kind of be just overwhelmed what their group is doing. And whilst all that is going on, a person of colour, their experience is that they're in pain, they're expressing their hurt, and actually that's not being met by the group. The group is thinking about themselves being hurt, or, you know, trying to help out or something like that. So it can be a very isolating experience for that person, and then they decide to not say anything. The feelings are sort of too big. The feelings kind of get pushed back on that person. You know, are they being allies, these people? Not really. So the trainers forum, I mean, what I do there is when people kind of veer off and go off wherever they're going in their own personal stuff, I just sort of bring their attention back to, you know, the person who's speaking, you know, the actual hurt that they're experiencing.
And sometimes, but it's about them rather than everyone else's.
Yeah, so it's about, so we're focusing on this person and their experience in the world. And what tends to happen is that everyone else's experience of the world kind of gets organized and that person feels kind of left out. And it's hard work to bring people back to the person who's in pain. So even with good intentions, people get lost and confused, and it gets very, very difficult. And it's very frustrating if you're talking to you about your experience and then someone says, well, what do you want me to do about it? All you want to do is just be kind of heard. You want the other person to feel it. I think that's the bottom line. I think you want the other person you want them to sort of have a sense of your experience. And it's largely, I mean, it may be verbal, it may be a sort of verbal kind of whatever thing, but it's mainly non-verbal. It's kind of just the way that people are, the way they look at you, you know, the tone of their voice, kind of things that they say and do. They don't want to fix it particularly, fix you, tweak stuff. You know, this is the world that we're living in, and this is how it is. There's a big journey for people to make. I think certainly around feminism, around race, they were kind of, I mean, a lot of those oppressions, they're quite big journeys to make. There is one kind of theory around by someone called Robin DiAngelo, who calls it white fragility. This idea where, for white people, being comfortable around race is what they kind of expect and what they actually demand. Once you start having a race conversation, you need to say it in a nice way, or you need to say it in a way that's kind of not got any spikes to it. And as long as they're kind of feeling okay and comfortable-ish, then the conversation can continue. But if they're feeling uncomfortable, then they reassert their right for racial comfort by denying that racism exists or being silent and kind of just looking at you blankly. And then they lose contact with you. When certainly in those kinds of PD groups, or even just in ordinary life, someone's talking about their experience and then there's this kind of sense that they're not listening. So you kind of speak a bit louder. Still not listening. Speak louder still. You know, got a chip on your shoulder. You're starting to shout now. I don't want to hear the shout. Can you tell me in a nice way?
Well, that's the irony,
kind
though.
Of pushing this sense of hurt into the other, and they're not picking it up. They're not taking it. They're not kind of seeing the hurt. And then there's a break in the relationship because the other person feels, well, you can't help me. I'm on my own. Yeah. Or I'll just go back to my peeps and, you know, I'll be comfortable there because it's too uncomfortable coming out and speaking.
I wonder if this dynamic comes up of, like, say, if there's, like, a white person or whatever. Is there ever a sense that the very fact that they've decided to listen to you makes them so great and you should be so grateful that they're even engaging with this? And in a way, it's weird having this conversation because you're talking about your experiences with race and as a therapist, and I'm bringing it back to and men and feminism.
No, you should do.
So I'm doing the same thing that you've said people do.
Oh, see what you mean, yeah.
But then you did know in advance.
We're here to talk about that, so, you know.
But I want to say, I know that there is a bit of an irony that you're talking about your experience. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is about when I talked to some guy. Because there is this thing a lot with men where, like, and I'm like, okay, it's great you want to help out, but A, like, you don't deserve a medal. Like, you know, everything's great for you, so get over yourself a little bit. You're not doing me a huge favour by, like, wanting to make a little bit of an effort. And maybe that sounds mean and it hurts their feelings, but I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, is it so bad to hurt people's feelings? Because we grow through pain and through being uncomfortable. Mm. So if someone who's the dominant group feels a bit uncomfortable, you were saying earlier that part of what the person who's speaking wants is that they want to be heard and for other people to feel how they feel.
Yeah.
So in a way, if the dominant person in that scenario, if they feel uncomfortable, maybe that's good. Like, we're doing the right thing because, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, if there's an understanding that they're going to feel uncomfortable, that's what I'm trying to bring across to people. Before we start the conversation, are you willing to go through the uncomfortableness of it? And they might say, well, no. Okay. Fair enough. Because if they're not willing to do that, then there's no point in me putting my effort in. if they say yes, how much discomfort is there? So, well, I don't know. You have to sort of feel it and see, feel it for yourself. It's normally not an agreement, yes, I'm willing to feel pain. But if they know that that's part of the process...
They're aware that it could happen.
There's a chance then that the pain will kind of keep them... That sort of cognitive awareness might keep them in the game a little bit longer. Whereas if they didn't know it was coming, they would have just sort of... They'd run off, or they'd go into some kind of defence, or they'd want to be praised for their efforts. That uncomfortableness is kind of part of the journey, really. The difficulty with a lot of the groups is that you know that, you know, uncomfortableness is going to be part of the journey, but you also know that if it's too uncomfortable, there's not going to be conversation at all. I think that's kind of where I was going with the sort of pandering kind of thing. If you're deeply into feminism, or you're thinking about your identity, race and so on, it's harder to have sort of meet those allies in some way, because you're kind of slightly way ahead of them in some ways.
Mm.
But I think for people who are in the oppressed group and who aren't quite aware of where they are or their position, I think it can be very, right? I mean, for me, it was transformative to know that there was this other person who was just like, okay, they're clearly way ahead of this game than I am, and I'm in the oppressed group. So that was quite a really significant and important part of me becoming the therapist that I am. And also...
That they got it.
They got me even before I got myself.
And without them having to have had your experience, they got you.
Yeah. In this particular case, it was a South African woman, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But anyway, the conditions were such that in her life, she kind of got down to the very uncomfortable places that you need to get to and sort of, you know, dealt with her stuff.
Mm.
So she was able to, and it was quite, it wasn't very overt what she was doing. She wasn't saying, you know, you need to stand up for yourself. It wasn't anything like that. It was just how she was. When we meet as people of colour, often people are raging in those spaces. People are raging and they want to feel met with that rage.
But it's not a problem though. I think, okay, if people of colour are angry, sort of white people need to hear that they're angry, right?
Yes.
Otherwise they don't fathom how serious it is.
Yeah. And certainly with race, the anger is, or the rage, I would sort of put it that, it has a lot of connotations to it. It's mainly between men, isn't it?
Hmm.
Or the revolts have been around men fighting, and there's been a lot of bloodshed around it. So the black rage is terrifying to the white other, and it's also terrifying to express as well. There's also a potential backlash.
Hmm.
And I don't know how it feels in the feminist field. It's very intense. But I think there is definitely a place for rage, you know, certainly in certain forums, I think, where it's mostly maybe people of colour, but there's a mixed audience. I get more in touch with the rage part, and that comes out more.
Mm-hmm.
It does create a feeling of connection within the group. The other people who are there who aren't people of colour, and they're just there. I mean, they're there for a good, you know, they're there to sort of get some of that as well, actually. They're actually there to share the experience. But yeah, no, I think rage is essential, really, that is a part of change, isn't it?
When you talked about potential backlash, you mean that, especially as a black man, if you speak out, there could be like serious consequences towards you? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Just need to look at the civil rights movement in America. It was really about black people raging, and then there's the backlash, people getting killed, people getting assassinated. There is this sort of death sitting in the background around certainly rage, race and rage.
But then at the same time, that rage can lead to change as well.
Yeah, rage can lead to change, yeah.
Mm.
There's a sort of sense of putting your life on the line. There's that kind of idea. Well, it's not an idea, it's a reality.
That was Eugene Ellis. Okay, it's time to give Jonathan a call. Here it goes.
So, Jonathan, we heard from Jackson Katz and Eugene Ellis. What are your thoughts?
first to go to Jackson. I mean, I thought Jackson's comment about how men have a tendency to sort of shut down when they feel like they're getting some form of resistance because they may not be saying something right, so they automatically shut down. And I loved his comment about the fact that if you're shutting down and you're saying, okay, I'm just not going to do anything, he's like, then I question your commitment to trying to solve this problem.
It's funny because I find the way Jackson talks, it's like a little bit of a call to men, the language he uses and stuff, which
sure.
I find, I don't know, because I'm quite into that stuff. I think it's really cool. And I wonder if that's an especially effective way to appeal to men, because the way he talks, something just like that, like, I question your commitment, you know, it very much brings in all these notions like duty and honor and responsibility.
Well, there was,
and it's kind of interesting he uses that sort of language.
It's sort of a more subtle version of saying, hey, listen, you know, man up.
Right, exactly.
In terms of that, like almost sort of challenging the level of, you know, when he says he's challenging your level of commitment, you know, it's almost like he's challenging your level of strength. And so to a certain extent, it becomes one of these stronger, weaker kind of dynamics that certainly appeals linguistically, I think, to men.
I think it's great because I feel like the way he talks, I'm like, that's just the right way to frame it, because it's less like, oh, you got it wrong. It's more like, no, you can do better and I'm calling on you to do better. I don't know. It's just really cool hearing that sort of language.
Sure. I had a question for you, which was, I really liked his comment about pro-feminist men in terms of a linguistic term. I thought it was nice, you know, he commented about, like, men shouldn't be calling themselves feminist, which you and your friend had mentioned last season, and I know, you know, is sort of not, I'm not going to say a trigger word for you, but it's certainly borders
male feminist.
Yes, male feminists. But, you know, what did you think about that term, like pro-feminist men?
I thought it was brilliant. And what was really interesting speaking to Jackson was that it was one of those interviews where I basically asked hardly any questions, because it was almost like he knew what I was thinking and he just answered things that I was going to ask anyway. That was one of those moments where I was like, no, this is someone who gets it. But like he said, you know, him and men like him have spent a lot of time in these discussions and in these debates. I mean, in the last episode, the problem with male feminists was largely about using feminism to brand yourself. And I just feel like the way he acknowledged that, no, you have to be careful about this language, was kind of really cool. So yeah, I liked that a lot.
Yeah, no, I liked the term as well. And I thought that the, you know, sort of the definition of being supportive, but not in any way sort of invade, it felt like it was a way of echoing support without invading someone else's space.
Yes. But the other thing I really liked about what Jackson was saying was that he was saying that it's okay to make mistakes and you should expect to make mistakes and it doesn't make you a bad person, which I think is super important. And it comes up a lot because, you know, often, and it's not even in discussions about feminism or whatever, you know, just think of like having an argument with a friend. Like sometimes you're upset with someone and you have the right to be upset with them, and instead of listening to you, they take it as a like, oh, I'm such a bad person, and they'll either shut down or they'll attack you, which is not the best response, you know. And I think Jackson's whole thing of like, no, you're gonna make mistakes, that's fine, don't be afraid, just stay committed basically and persevere, I thought that was like a really important point, which is interesting because I feel Eugene Ellis, our second guest, was saying something kind of similar when he was talking about race and trying to get his white colleagues to listen to the concerns of people of color. Again, he was very much talking about how it is not easy and it's a long journey. This isn't an overnight thing that you're just going to get someone else's experience. It's a long journey, and white people in this case should expect that it's going to be uncomfortable. And I think the other point that's really important here is that, like, we grow through pain and through discomfort. So just the fact that a lot of men right now are feeling uncomfortable, that's a really good thing. And if they can stay with that and know that, no, when you're feeling uncomfortable, that's when good stuff is happening, and just, you know, expect that it's going to be like that for a little bit, I think that could be a real positive thing, instead of thinking, oh my God, this is uncomfortable, I'm going to run away, or I'm going to have a backlash, or I'm going to shut down and not engage. No, if you're feeling pain, that's good. That means that something good is happening, you're growing, it's going forward. Kind of like what you and I and our guest Dan were talking about in our bonus episode about Me Too and dating, that, like, yeah, it's not necessarily bad if men are starting to feel uncomfortable.
Sure. I mean, let me challenge you, though, a bit on the growing through pain, because, I mean, I kind of think...
I'm really into stuff like that, by the way. I'm really like, old school hardcore.
I know.
I'm like...
I know. But, I mean, I think that, like, I think it's important to note that pain is not required for growth.
And that I think if you're saying you're growing through pain, I mean, I think, you know, there's a tendency to a certain extent of saying that, you know, being uncomfortable, being in pain is required to grow. There's a natural need, I think, to grow when you're in pain or uncomfortable because, you know, you don't want to kind of maintain that as a status quo. No one likes being mm-hmm. uncomfortable. No one likes being in pain. I mean, unless, of course, you're a masochist, which, you know. There's certainly an argument that I am being a doctoral student, but I think, you know, it's important to note that growth can happen naturally and maybe not as consistently and yada, yada, yada. But at the same time, I think the goal should be to grow without pain. The goal should be...
I don't know, man. I feel like often when I have grown, it's because I've had to face something that I didn't want to face because it was easier not to deal with a problem. But then the problem doesn't go away. And I feel like on a social level, it's the same. It's like, for example, staying with the recent climate over the past few months in terms of gender relationships, like women have suppressed a lot of things and a lot of experiences because it's been dangerous for them to come out with them. And now that they are coming out and revealing this stuff, a lot of men are forced to look at it. Just like Jackson Katz said at the start of his talk, he's like, you know, men can no longer be in denial.
I thought that was a great point.
Like often denial is a way of avoiding pain or, you know, not dealing with it. Just like both Jackson and Eugene talked about that, about, you know, there's a break in the relationship because someone doesn't want to feel uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm
why do they not want to feel uncomfortable? Because they have to look at something that they don't want to look at. They have to look at the fact that maybe life is unfair, maybe they're privileged, maybe they have done things that they shouldn't have done, or even if they're completely innocent, just the fact that they benefit from being who they are, that's not a nice thing to look at, and it's not someone's fault, but, you know, they're in pain because they have to look at a truth that is uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with any of that, but I think my basic point is that, you know, people can choose to grow without necessarily having to experience a painful or uncomfortable experience. Like, this is not...
That's true.
This is not pain-dependent. Growth is not pain-dependent. And
no, but it often helps.
It absolutely helps.
You need the pain to bother.
No, absolutely.
Eugene brought up something really interesting where he said that often what you want is for the other person to feel what you're feeling, for them to sort of understand it. And so they don't necessarily need to say anything. And that was really interesting because it kind of reminded me of when you and I initially talked about this right at the start of this episode. And, you know, I was talking about how, like, women really want men to listen and to just, you know, just listen.
Absolutely.
And so I feel like what Eugene was saying was that, like, he wants people to get it, to understand, to empathize, you know, to feel it. And that was interesting because I'm thinking, like, oh, maybe that's what me and the women I know mean when we say that we just want men to listen. And then the other thing he said that was really interesting
was that women want men to just sort of feel through the experience?
Yeah, to empathize, to get it, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And I think that's the problem with when men, even if they're well-meaning, when they sort of jump up and try and fix things. And it's like, no, I don't necessarily want that right now. And because I do a lot of therapy and stuff, that is basically what therapy is all about. It's about being seen. And a lot of healing comes from the fact that someone else has acknowledged your experience.
What do you mean by being seen? That's an interesting term that you use.
Being seen is for someone to notice that you're going through something, to acknowledge that you're going through something.
But isn't that sort of a different way of saying being empathetic to someone's situation?
I guess so, yeah. But there is a lack of empathy or understanding. And I'm not blaming men because, like, you know, obviously they have a different experience of the world. But just when someone who isn't you understands and says, that's really shitty, or that really sucks, or I'm really sorry you went through that, and they genuinely mean that, that in itself is quite powerful. The other thing Eugene said that was interesting was when he talked about how when someone who is not of the oppressed group can acknowledge what you're going through, there's something really transformational and powerful about that. And again, for me, it was kind of quite moving hearing that because it made me think of my shrink, who is like upper middle class white English male, who is, I don't know, above 60 or something. And I feel like he was the first person who really got me as a young woman and the things I go through. Very similar to what Eugene was saying about his white female South African therapist and how she got him. And that was a really powerful moment. You know, it got me thinking because on one hand, I was thinking, is this a bit odd? Because in some ways it sounds like Eugene and I are sort of saying that we need someone of the more quote unquote privileged group to acknowledge us for us to feel like our pain is legitimate. But that's kind of not what it is. It's more like the feeling that those people who didn't have that experience actually understood the experience, and also maybe a feeling that they have also...
Was it dependent necessarily on someone else from the different class, from a different color, from a different gender acknowledging it, or was it necessarily important that it was just a human being was able to acknowledge?
No, I feel, I don't want to talk on behalf of Eugene, but for me, I feel like the fact that it's someone of the more quote-unquote privileged or dominant group, the fact that they got it was powerful in itself. And it sort of indicated that with me and my therapist, and what Eugene seemed to be saying about the therapist he talked about, was that these are people who have had to do the work and have made the effort to understand, even if they didn't have to, because they were already in a position of privilege. And there's something about that that is quite powerful. Like with my therapist, like he didn't have to get to a point where he got my experience as a young woman, but he did. And he got it even before I got myself, which is exactly what Eugene was saying. So I don't know, this kind of takes me back to Jackson a little bit, and when he was sort of in a way calling on men to step up, and that there's like a duty and a responsibility when you're in the position of privilege. Listening to Eugene and to thinking of my own experience with like my therapist, it just made me think that's a really powerful thing that someone in the sort of dominant group can do.
No, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I can understand and appreciate that. I appreciate the clarification, because, you know, the question is whether sometimes some of these experiences just need, you know, a human being to acknowledge pain. But at the same time, you're saying, I appreciate that, you know, you're saying there was an added bonus. It was an added, it made it more a more powerful experience for it to be someone who was quite literally the opposite of me.
Yeah, someone who didn't have to get it.
Someone who had everything going for them.
Doesn't experience it.
Right. Yeah. No, I get that.
So, Jonathan, we started this episode trying to answer the question, how can men best help feminism? After our conversation, after talking to Jackson and Eugene, and after going away and thinking about this a lot, I really feel that the best thing men can do is to get stuck in and to persevere and to keep going and to expect that it's going to hurt, but that is not a bad thing. So it's like, yeah, the best thing you can do is to, like, not shy away from it. Get stuck in. Just, you know, be really committed and, like, you know, don't be afraid of making mistakes. Don't be afraid of getting hurt. And you are going to get hurt, but just keep going and show that you care.
Yeah, I mean, coming back out of that, I really liked his term pro-feminist men. I think, you know, I, again, being the social scientist nerd that I am, I like definitions and I like terms that, not necessarily because they box me in, but because they, like, definitions help clarify things for me. And I think, kind of to your point, I liked what you were saying earlier about feeling your way through something, is that it's not necessarily that it's a road with a necessarily a clear, distinct points along the journey, but just that you're committed to being on the journey. And that feeling your way through it necessarily than trying to tick off certain boxes of being a quote-unquote woke man, I think are... you know, it's more important to be there, to be present, to be, again, to be feeling, to be empathetic, which I think we touched on a great deal.
Yeah, and it's funny hearing you say that, because what you've just said, that is basically the definition of just being a decent friend as well. You know, like, you're there, you're empathetic.
Sure.
You listen, you make an effort. We just need to do that on a bigger social scale.
Right. You know, my conclusion is not not so much a takeaway, but necessarily a goal for men to be more empathetic, to be more aware, to be more self-aware and understanding, not just to the women in our lives specifically, but to the broader dialogue that's going on in society.
I personally, at this moment, I call on men and I challenge them to step up and get stuck in. Do you think that's an effective way to appeal to them?
I don't know. We'll find out. We need more men listening to the podcast.
You heard from Jackson Katz and Eugene Ellis on this episode of The Gender Knot, where we asked, how can men best help feminism?
It was hosted by me. I'm Naz, or Naz Drantavakoli-Farr in full.
And it was hosted by me. I'm Jonathan Freeman.
And we'll speak to you next week. Bye for now.
Speak to you later.